two, three.
Okay, great.
All right, so let's go back to the setting of the first lecture, and remember that there were various results for CM of Rn, restricted to finite sets E. So today, in the first lecture, I'd like to explain how those results are related to one another. The bottom line is that they all follow from one main result, and then the next two lectures after this one will explain how to prove that one result. Okay, so let me just set up notation, which is almost but not quite identical to the first lecture. So we fix a little m and a little m. Capital X is Cm of Rn, that's the space of all m times continuously differentiable functions for which the norm is finite. There's the, there on the slide, I hope you can see it, is the Cm norm. Okay. And for a subset E, which today, but not always, will be finite, if E is a subset of Rn, X of E is the space of restrictions to E of functions in Cm, and therefore if E is finite, X of E is all functions, but the norm is the interesting thing. The norm of F in the space X of E is the inf of the Cm norm of all extensions. Okay? So that's as in the first lecture. As in the first lecture, please stop me if anything is not 100% clear, especially if it's not visible. Okay? Jx of f today is going to be the m minus first degree Taylor polynomial of f at x. The slide helpfully includes the definition of the Taylor polynomial. It helpfully contains a misprint because where alpha goes only up to m minus 1, not up to m. Okay. So j of x, the Taylor polynomial or the jet of f at x, belongs to script p, the vector space of all such polynomials. Okay, that's the notation. Okay, all right, X is Cm of Rn. We have constants denoted by the letter C, little c, big C, C prime, whatever, and those always simply depend on M and N. So I'm going to set up a notation that less than with a tilde underneath means less than or equal to something times a constant, as on the slide, the constant, again, depending only on little m, and A of the same order of magnitude as B, written as on the slide with the tilde. A is of the same order of magnitude of B if A and B are non-negative quantities and each one is dominated by a constant C times the other. Okay, that's the notation. Okay, let's see if we've got enough notation. Okay, yes. So let me recall the theorems from the first lecture and a few more. Okay, so E is our finite set. Capital N, as always, is the number of points in the finite set. The first theorem is that we can compute the order of magnitude of the norm using only N log N computer operations and at most O of N memory. So that's the computation of the norm. Okay. The second theorem that was discussed in the first lecture was that given a function on a finite set E, we can efficiently compute an extension whose norm is as small as possible up to a factor C, and efficiently compute means that we do one-time work and then answer queries, and the one-time work is O of N log N, the query work is O of log N, and the number of memory cells, the number of real numbers we should be able to store is at most O of N. So that's the computation of the extension. Okay, that's the second thing. All right. Now, remember that it was supposed to be important to compute a certain possibly empty convex set as given on this slide, namely gamma of xm is the set of all jets at x of interpolants that have norm at most m. So we're given a function little f on e, we're given a point x, let's say in e, actually it needn't be in e, but today it will be. M is a positive number, and so we define this gamma of xm, and the claim is that a very good thing to do is to understand the approximate size and shape of gamma. Okay, so we're going to do that today, we're sort of going to state the results, and that's going to be the hard work. This has been a quick review. It was a long day yesterday. Are we all good with this? Anyone want to complain? No? Okay. In order to understand gamma, which is the task of the moment, we're going to define convex sets gamma L of Xm for X in E, M positive, and L, a non-negative integer. We're going to define these by induction on L. The idea is gamma is a thing we would like to compute, but we don't a priori understand. Whereas the gamma L are things that we can compute. Gamma 0 will be a trivially defined thing. Gamma L plus 1 will be defined by applying some process to the gamma L. And we're going to approximate gamma, the true gamma that we really care about, by these gamma L. Okay? The gamma L that we will define in a minute will have the following key properties. First of all of the gammas that we define are going to contain the true gamma. Furthermore, as L increases, the gamma L will get smaller. So hopefully, as L increases, the gamma L will be better and better approximates of the true gamma. And finally, for a large enough integer constant L star, which depends only on the little m and little n, you know, the parameters in the bottom space in which we measure smoothness, for a large enough integer constant L star, the gamma L star has approximately the same size and shape as the true gamma that we care about. So I'd like to define these gamma L's and establish these key properties. Okay, so what's the induction defining the gamma L? Well, in the base case, L equals 0, there's the definition of gamma 0 of Xm for all X in E and any positive M. And if you look at the slide, you can see that gamma 0 is simply the convex set of all jets at X for functions that do what an interpolate is supposed to, but only at the single point X, ignoring completely all information from all other points of the set E. Okay. So it's obvious that gamma 0 is a possibly empty convex set. It's empty because, for example, if f of X is big, but this number capital M is small, these finite conditions are contradictory. So this gamma 0 is a possibly empty convex set of elements of script P, of polynomials, and obviously it contains the true gamma, because anything in the true gamma, the jet of an actual interpolate, had better satisfy at least these conditions defining gamma 0. Okay? So we've defined gamma 0 of Xm for all X and E. All right, here's the induction step. Let's fix an L, and let's fix a positive M. And let's suppose that we've already defined gamma L of Xm for all X in E. I'm then going to define gamma L plus 1 of Xe for of Xm for all X in E. And of course, if I can do that, that will complete the induction and define all the gamma L's. So here's the definition. Gamma L plus 1 of Xm consists of all polynomials P in gamma L of Xm with the property on the slide. Namely, given any y in E, there is a p prime in gamma L of Ym, which we've already computed. The gamma L is what we've already computed. The claim is there exists a p prime in that gamma L such that the estimate that you see there is satisfied. So what that means, for example, is that if y is very close to x, and we look at a given P in gamma L to decide whether it belongs to gamma L plus 1 of Xm, well, if that P is going to qualify, there had better be a P prime in gamma L of Ym very close to gamma L of Xm. Is the condition clear? Okay. Notice that if we are looking at the jet of of an actual interpolate, so that P belongs to the true gamma, then we could take our P prime to be the jet of that interpolate at Y, and the desired estimate simply follows immediately from Taylor's theorem. So, as promised, we've defined gamma L by induction on L, and an easy induction on L using Taylor's theorem shows that all the gamma L contain the true gamma. And furthermore, the definition of gamma L shows at once that the gamma L decreases with L, because gamma L plus 1 was defined to be the set of all polynomials in gamma L such that something or other. Okay. So those properties are immediately clear. And so the theorem I'd like to state is that for a large enough integer constant L star depending only on little m and little m, we have the inclusions on the slide. So the gamma L star of Xm obviously contains the gamma of Xm by the previous simple discussion. But the non-trivial theorem is that gamma of Xm contains gamma L star of Xcm. And here's the next borderline misprint, that uppercase C ought to be lowercase c. That's a small constant depending on the little m and little m. Okay? So I'm going to call that computation of the gammas. Now, as a corollary of that, if the gamma L star is non-empty for some x in E, then the norm of little f in x of E is less than or equal to a constant times m. Because if the gamma L star is empty, then for a slightly larger m, you find that the gamma is not empty. Gamma consists of all jets of interpolants, and if that's non-empty, then the set of interpolants is non-empty. And so there is an interpolant with norm at most Cm. So that follows immediately from theorem 3, and that's going to allow a calculation of the norm. Okay. Now the next theorem, I think from last time? No, I think I did mention this. Oh yes, I did, I'm sorry. The next theorem, again, concerns interpolation and extension, starting from finite subsets of Rn. The claim is that there is a linear map that allows you to interpolate. So there's a linear map T from X of E to X with the property that for any F in X of E, first of all, TF agrees with F on E, so TF is an extension. And furthermore, the norm of TF in CM is at most a constant times the norm of F in the space X of E, so that means that the norm of TF is within a constant factor of the inf of all possible CM norms of all interpolants that agree with the data. Furthermore, we can take that T to have a simple form. So given any X in Rn, TF of X can be written as a linear combination of the values of F at the points of E. So far, that's just true for any linear map from X of E to CM. Just because a linear function on a finite dimensional vector space can be written out in terms of the basis with coefficients. But for each particular x, there are only a bounded number, there are at most a bounded number of non-zero coefficients, lambda of x, y. And so I called that last time bounded depth. So not only is there a linear extension operator, but the linear extension operator has the sparse structure, it has bounded depth. All right. Furthermore, that T can be computed efficiently. So after we do one-time work O of n log n, using storage, number of memory cells at most O of n, we can answer queries. A query consists of a point x, and the response to query x is the family of non-zero coefficients lambda of x, y. So we can efficiently compute the linear extension operator. And the work to answer a query is at most C log n. And so this linear extension operator not only exists, but can be efficiently computed. Okay, the next theorem is what I called before the refined finiteness theorem. Here it's usually called the sharp finiteness theorem. It's always a mistake to call a new theorem sharp, because there's always a sharper theorem. But today this is called the sharp finiteness theorem. So given a set E with capital N elements as usual, there is a list of little subsets, so the number of these little subsets grows only linearly in n, the number of points of E. Each one of these subsets is indeed a little subset and has the most bounded number of points in it. And furthermore, um, all right, right? So notice, so far I've just talked about the set E, but now in the last assertion, the claim is that for any function defined on E, the norm of that function in X of E is comparable to the maximum of the norms that you get by restricting F to each of these little subsets and trying to extend from them. As on the slide. Okay, so that's yesterday's refined finiteness theorem, today's sharp finiteness theorem. Okay. And moreover, those sets can be efficiently computed from E, namely they can be computed from E using at most n log n operations and at most cn storage. Okay. And remember that if S is a set with at most c elements, we know how to compute the order of magnitude of F in X of S by simple linear algebra, thanks to the Whitney extension theorem in the case of finite sets. Okay, that's from lecture two yesterday. Okay, so in principle, that will answer the problem of computing. Okay, I spoke also about removing outliers. So remember, given a function on a finite set E, as usual, E has n elements. Suppose we have an integer z smaller than n, and we want to find a subset of E with at most z elements in such a way that if we remove the elements of S from the set E and look at the remaining extension problem, the norm of that is as small as possible. So we want to remove the troublemakers and leave the fellows that allow for a nice smooth extension of controlled CM norm. That's probably a very difficult problem, but here's an easier version which we're going to solve. So the easier version is we're going to compute a subset S sub Z with the property that it contains at most a constant times Z elements rather than less than or equal to Z. Now it's less than or equal to a constant times Z. And it meets competitors in the following sense. If you take any competing subset S contained in E and you require that the competing subset have at most Z elements, then by removing S sub Z, you get you wind up with a norm which is not much bigger than the norm you could get by removing S. So the estimate is there on the slide. There's a constant factor C, and so SC is going to be called almost optimal. And so almost optimal means that you cannot do much better, reduce the CM norm much more by removing far fewer elements. That's what almost optimal means. Okay. And the theorem then from last time is that given a function, you can make a computation in n squared log n time using storage Cn, and what we compute is an enumeration of the elements of the set E. So we write them as a first one, a second one, and so on through the nth, in such a way that for any Z, this set of the first CZ of these elements is almost optimal. Okay, so this is the good way to enumerate S so that the somehow the first element is the worst, the second element is the second worst, and so on. And so we're going to make an efficient computation of such an enumeration. It's already, I think, interesting to say that such an enumeration exists, but in fact, so that's removing outliers. Okay, so those are six theorems about CM or RM restricted to finite sets. And what I'd like to discuss next is how these theorems are logically related to one another. Which ones imply which other ones? So here's the diagram. The theorem on the gamma L implies more or less the theorem on the existence of linear extension operators of bounded depth. That theorem, in turn, means that you can compute an extension, and it also implies the sharp finiteness theorem, the refined finiteness theorem, which in turn allows you to remove outliers and to compute the norm. Okay, those are the implications. Let me explain a little bit how I've marked the arrows. So first of all, the top arrow, the theorem on the gammas, implies the theorem on linear extension operators. It's not that the theorem itself implies the theorem on linear extension. extension operators. It's rather the proof of the theorem on the gamma L's with a little bit of extra work yields as a byproduct of the existence of these linear extension operators. I will explain just a little bit at the very end of this talk how that goes. Okay. Let's look at the words obvious. Okay. So the theorem on linear extension operators implies you can compute an extension. Because if I give you a particular function to extend, and I want to compute an extension, I can just take the linear extension operator, which allegedly I can compute, and apply it to the function. And that gives me an extension. And if you check the statements about how many computer operations it takes to do this or that, it all just follows immediately. So that's why that's obvious. Okay. Let's look at why the Sharpe-Climacus theorem obviously implies the computation of the norm. Remember, the Sharpe-Climacus theorem says that the norm of little f on some big finite set E is comparable to the maximum of norms of restrictions of that function to some little subsets. For each little subset, we know how to compute the order of magnitude of the corresponding norm, because that's an application of Whitney's extension theorem for finite sets, as explained in the last lecture. And so to compute the norm of little f on some great big finite set E, we just take the maximum of a whole lot of fellows, each of which we know how to compute. And so that's why that's obvious. Okay, is that clear? I absolutely don't want to snow anybody. And it's very easy to be snowed, especially by somebody who sits up here and says rapidly that something's obvious. Okay? All right, so now let's look at the things that were not labeled as obvious. I'm going to start by explaining why the Sharpe-Climacus theorem shows that we can remove outliers. Okay. So let's remember the Sharpe-Climacus theorem. There it is on the slide. You can compute the norm of a function little f in x of e as the maximum of some little guys, f restricted to x and of s of k. The S of k's are little subsets, they're big O of n of them. We can compute them, and for each one of them, using Whitney's theorem for finite sets, we can compute a number that I'm calling Y sub k, which is comparable to the norm of f on little subsets. Okay, so that's what we're going to use in order to remove outliers. Okay, so please remember the notation. The slide is about to disappear, but remember the notation. Okay? All right. So here's the algorithm which we're going to use to enumerate E. So we start with an empty list, lambda. All right, now we enter a loop. So we compute our S1 to SK loop. We compute our S1 to SK and Y1 to YK as on the previous slide. We then look at the YK and we pick out the biggest one. So let's say that's YK hat. Maybe there happens to be a tie. We would pick from either one. Okay, so we pick k hat to maximize the y. Having picked k hat, we then have our little subset s sub k hat, and we append that to lambda in any order. Having done that, we then delete the elements of sk from e. So we're growing the list lambda, but shrinking the set e. We then look at what we've got. Maybe what we've got is the empty set, in which case we stop. Otherwise, we go back to step one and just do it all over again. And so we're in a loop and we keep on executing the loop until we stop. That's the algorithm to enumerate the set E. And at the end of the algorithm, the algorithm terminates, and the resulting list at the termination of the algorithm is the enumeration of the elements of E promised in theorem 6. Okay? That's the claim. Okay, let's see why. So first of all, the algorithm terminates because every time you execute the loop, you remove some stuff from E, and so sooner or later it will be empty. Lambda is an enumeration of all the elements of E, because as we delete stuff from E, we have added it on to lambda. And so by the time E shrinks to the empty set, lambda will have all the elements of the original E. So all of that is obvious. Okay, let's look at S of Z, that's going to be the contents of the list lambda after we have executed steps 1 through 5 for the zth time. That's not quite the same as the SC in the previous discussion, but nevertheless, let's take that to be SC. And I promise you what I'm sweeping under the rug is trivial. Okay, so SC is the contents of the list lambda just after we have executed the loop for the zth time. I have to show you, first of all, that SC contains at most CZ elements, and I also have to show you that SC is almost optimal in the sense that if S is any competing subset with at most Z elements, then we have an inequality for the norms as on the slide. Okay, that would say that SC is almost optimal, and if I can prove that stuff, then that proves that my algorithm works. Okay? All right. Now, the fact that SC contains at most CZ elements is completely obvious because every time we execute the loop, we have taken one of our little subsets and appended it to the list lambda. That means each time we execute the loop, we append at most a bounded number, at most C elements. And so after we execute the loop C times, we will have appended to the empty list at most CZ elements. So our control of the number of points in SC is clear. Okay? No objection? No objection was entered into the room. Okay. So there's one non-trivial assertion of the whole thing, which is that this SC beats competitors, as on the slide. Okay? So let's call that assertion star. And I'm going to prove that by induction on Z. Now, of course, if I want to prove a thing like that by induction on Z, it's very important that the constant C not grow from Z to Z plus 1. But I promise you that in the argument that you're about to see, the constant C does not grow in the induction step. Okay, so I want to prove star by induction on Z. For Z equals 0, in other words, before we have executed the loop at all, S of Z and S are both empty. S of Z starts empty, and S is supposed to have at most Z elements. If Z is 0, they're both empty. And so star refers to either removing the empty set SZ or removing the empty set S, and this estimate is just obvious. It's nothing. Okay? So for Z equals 0, everything, this desired estimate is obvious. And so what we've got to do is assume that the estimate star for Z minus 1, we're going to prove it for Z. Okay, so here's what we're supposed to do, why this is true. Now, we have to look at any competitor S. S might be a weak competitor or a strong competitor. A weak competitor is a competitor that has the property that if you remove S from E, that doesn't change the order of magnitude of the norm. It doesn't reduce it. S is a strong competitor if, by removing S, you greatly reduce the norm, as shown on the slide. Okay? And so we have to prove the inequality at the top of the slide in these two cases. Okay. Now, if S is a weak competitor, life is easy, because the norm of F, if you try to extend F from E minus SZ, that's obviously less than or equal to the norm of F in X of E. Right? Growing the set E causes the norm to increase for trivial reasons. So that's less than or equal to X of E. And because S is allegedly a weak competitor, that means that the norm of F in X of E has the same order of magnitude as the norm of F in X of E minus S. So you have the inequality at the bottom of the slide, which says that indeed our S sub Z beats S. Okay, so we can easily beat a weak competitor. Let's see what happens if we beat a strong competitor. So that's a more serious thing. So we have to prove the inequality of the box on the top of the slide, that if we remove SC, that's less than or equal to some constant times the norm of F that you get by removing S. Well, all right. Why is this true? Okay, remember the loop 1 through 5. Is it okay if I don't zip back to the relevant slide? Do you remember the notation? Should I zip back? Okay, silence makes consent. Okay, so, all right, so the S's and Y's are as they would be the very first time we execute the loop. So remember, we found our SK and our SK hat, and our SK hat is contained in SC, because the very first thing we do when we execute our algorithm is to include SK hat that we appended to the empty list. And so then, as Z increases, we append more stuff, but we've always got SK hat contained in SC. Okay. That's just by the nature of the algorithm. But now we're going to see something, finally we're going to see something serious, which is that our strong competitor S contains at least one of the points of the set SK hat. That's the crucial observation. Let's see why it's true and then let's use it. Okay, so why is it that our strong competitor contains at least one point of SK hat? Well, suppose not. Suppose that the intersection is empty. Then SK hat would be contained in E minus S, and I'm going to get a contradiction from that. So let's look in the box. YK hat was, by definition, something comparable to the norm of F in X SK hat. Now, I'm assuming that SK hat is contained in E minus S, and so we get the next inequality, that the norm of F in X of SK hat is less than or equal to the norm of F in the larger set in X of E minus S. Now, S is a strong competitor, and therefore that norm of F in X of E minus S is small compared to the norm of F in X of E. However, remember that the SK came from the sharp finiteness theorem, and they have a property that the norm of F in X of E is comparable to the maximum of the norm of F with respect to the little subsets S of K. Furthermore, the defining property of the YK is that these norms of F in X of SK are comparable to the YK. And so what we've got next in the chain of inequalities is the maximum of the YK, and we pick YK hat to maximize the YK. So look at the chain of inequalities and we discover that YK hat is small compared to YK hat. That's highly unlikely, okay? And so we derive a contradiction from the assumption that our strong competitor contains no points of SK hat. Okay, so we've proven the basic observation, now we're going to use it. So let's complete the induction on Z. Here's what we want to prove, and what we do is we execute the loop the first time, we find our S of K hat, and then we define E tilde, F tilde, and S tilde as on the slide. We remove the elements of S K hat from E. F tilde is then simply the restriction of F to E tilde, and S tilde, the competing set, is simply the intersection of our original competing set S and V tilde. Notice that S tilde contains at most Z minus 1 points because we removed something from S. Okay? At least one of the elements of S belong to SK hat. S by assumption has at most Z elements, so S tilde has at most Z minus 1 elements. So we're getting into the setting of the induction hypothesis, which we look at S as Z minus 1. So let S tilde Z minus 1 be the contents of the list that I'm calling lambda tilde, obtained by executing steps 1 through 5, the loop Z minus 1 times, starting from the tilde data, E tilde F tilde, instead of E F. Okay? Is it clear? Okay. If you think about how the algorithm works, SZ is the same as the stuff we appended the first time, SK hat, union this S tilde ZK minus 1. And furthermore, that means that if you take E and remove SZ, that's the same as taking E tilde and removing S tilde Z minus 1. And similarly, E minus S is equal to E tilde minus S tilde. And And so the induction hypothesis applied to the tildes, so the induction hypothesis is that estimate star holds for C minus 1. If you apply that to the tildes, you find that F tilde in X, well, you find the inequality at the bottom of the slide, which tells you precisely that that's the same as the desired inequality because the left-hand side involving the tildes is identical to the left-hand side without the tildes, and the right-hand side with the tildes is identical to the right-hand side without the tildes. So in order to make sense of this, one should sit down and take a little time and just make the detailed verifications and check that the constant C doesn't grow during induction step. And that's true. And so that completes the induction on Z and proves that the algorithm works. And I would like to declare victory over outliers. So we have gotten from the refined finiteness theorem to the theorem on outliers. And so I'd like to discuss the next implication. Okay? So now there's let's go from linear extension operators and bounded depth to the Sharpe finiteness theorem. Okay, so here's how we're going to do that. First of all, we're going to bring in the well-separated Hare's decomposition. We're also going to bring in the linear extension operator of bounded depth, because the claim is that implies the Sharpe finiteness theorem. And we're going to put those two ingredients together and prove the Sharpe finiteness theorem. Okay. In order to do that, first I'd like to do a warm-up exercise. So remember the well-separated Hare's decomposition. There it is. D is an endpoint subset of Euclidean space. We look at E cross E minus the diagonal, and we partition it into Cartesian products so that the number of Cartesian products is only linear in the number of points of E, and furthermore, each Cartesian product is well-separated in the sense of the slide. Okay. For each of those Cartesian products, we're going to pick a representative, simply one point in the Cartesian product. And part of what Callahan and Kosaraj are doing in computing the well-separated pairs decomposition is that they compute such representatives, one for each Cartesian product, using at most O of n log n computer operations. Okay, so let's say we have the representatives. I owe you from lecture two, the task of computing the Lipschitz constant of a real valued function on the set E to within a 1% error in time n log n using the well-separated pairs decomposition. Okay? So the warm-up exercise is to see that. And what we're going to prove is that in order to calculate the Lipschitz constant, which is the left-hand side of the inequality here, it differs by at most a factor 1.01 by the restricted maximum, in which instead of looking at all points x and y, we look simply at the representatives. Okay. Now, once we know the representatives, it takes linear time, not even n log n, but linear time to compute that maximum. It takes time n log n to compute the representatives. Okay. So if we can prove this inequality, then we can compute efficiently the Lipschitz constant up to a 1% error. So to prove the inequality, I'm going to assume that the Lipschitz constant is 1 as measured only using the representatives as on the slide. And assuming that, I'm going to prove that that the actual Lipschitz constant, as x prime and x double prime vary, both independently over E, is at most 1.01. times x prime minus x double prime. Okay? All right. To prove that, I'm going to argue by contradiction. So suppose it's not true, then there's a counterexample. And I'm going to take that counterexample, x prime, x double prime, with a minimum distance between them. Okay? So that means that the top inequality holds because x prime and x double prime provide a counterexample. But if Z and W are strictly closer together than X prime to X double prime, then we don't have a counterexample, and therefore we have the second inequality on the slide. Okay? All right, so that's what we know about X prime and X double prime. We're assuming we've got that minimal counterexample, I really get a contradiction. Okay, now notice that x prime and x double prime cannot be the same because there's a strict inequality at the top of the slide. So x prime and x double prime together belong to e cross e minus the diagonal, and so they belong to one of our Cartesian products. So let's pick a new so that our x prime x double prime belongs to that Cartesian product. And let's say x nu prime x nu double prime in that Cartesian product is the corresponding representative. So far so good? Okay. Both x prime and x nu prime belong to e nu prime, and so their distance is at most the diameter of e nu prime. And similarly, e double prime and e nu double prime, I'm sorry, what did I say? X double prime and x nu double prime belong to e nu double prime, and so their distance is at most its diameter. Furthermore, e nu prime and e nu double prime are well separated, as I've reminded you on the slide. And therefore, x prime and x double prime are much farther apart than x prime to x nu prime or x double prime to x nu double prime, as on the last line. Okay? So please remember those little facts. Okay. Now, in particular, if we look at x prime and x nu prime, or x double prime and x nu double prime, their distance is strictly smaller than the distance from x prime to x double prime, so they're not a counterexample. X prime, x double prime was the minimal counterexample. Okay? And so we have the two inequalities in the first box there. That we can compare f of x prime with f of x nu prime, and that's at most 1.01 times the distance from x prime to x nu prime, and similarly for the double prime variables. Okay? Now remember, we're assuming that f of x nu prime minus f of x nu double prime is less than or equal to the distance from x nu prime to x nu double prime. And I'd like to use the triangle inequality now to bring in x prime and x double prime as on the slide. Okay? So now we have three inequalities for the difference of f's. We have we're comparing f of x prime to f of x nu prime. We're comparing f of x double prime with f of x nu double prime, and we're comparing f of x nu prime with f of x nu double prime. I can use the triangle inequality on those three estimates for the difference of f's. And so I find that f of x prime minus f of x double prime is, as on the slide, less than or equal to the sum of three terms. On the previous slide, we've estimated each of the three terms, and so we have the estimates that you see there. And so the main term is in the upper bound is going to be the distance from x prime to x double prime. But we also have, let's see, we have, for instance, the distance from x prime to x nu prime appearing twice, once with a coefficient 1 and once with a coefficient 1.01. Those add up to 2.01, which is less than 3. And so we have the estimates on the slide. Okay. So we have an estimate for f of x prime minus f of x double prime, and we recall that that is, we recall that the other two terms, the terms on the right-hand side there that are multiplied by 3, have the property that when you add them together, it's at most 1/1000th of the distance from x prime to x double prime. So if we plug that in, we conclude that the difference between absolute f there, difference between f of x prime and f of x double prime is at most 1 + 3/1000 times x prime minus x double prime, as on the first line. But wait a minute, the defining property of x prime and x double prime was that the difference between the f's is bigger than 1.01 times the distance. And that's a contradiction. 3/1000 is strictly less than 1/100. And so these inequalities contradict each other. And so assuming there's a counterexample, we've got a contradiction. And that proves the statement about Lipschitz constants, and that in turn completes the computation of the Lipschitz norm. We have done the warm-up exercise with 15 minutes left in the talk. Okay. All right, so the warm-up exercise is done. And now let's return to the proof that linear extension operators at bounded depth imply the Sharpe finiteness theorem. So In the same spirit as the warm-up exercise, we can prove the following lemma on Whitney fields. So this is the glorified warm-up exercise. Okay, same idea. Suppose that we're given a subset E with capital M points. We're given our well-separated pairs decomposition, E nu prime cross E nu double prime. We're given representatives, X nu prime, comma, X nu double prime. But now we're also given a positive number, capital M, and we're given a Whitney field on E. It's P super X for X and E. We're given all that stuff. Okay? All right. Suppose the estimate in the upper box, which refers only to the representatives. That's, you know, these are the estimates that we see over and over again that come from Taylor's theorem, but we're assuming them now only for the representatives. And the conclusion is that we get the same estimates, but for any pair of points in E, X and Y, and the capital M has increased by a constant. Maybe we can make that constant factor close to one, I don't care. Okay, so that's proven in the same spirit as the warm-up exercise. So let's just believe it. Okay, so that's what the well-separated pairs decomposition is going to do for us. Now let's set that aside, and let's bring in extension operators of bounded depth. So what I'm supposed to be proving for you now is that if there is a linear extension operator of bounded depth, then there is a refined finiteness theorem. And so let's simply assume that we're given a linear extension operator of bounded depth. And so given x in Rn, if we look at the jet at x of Tf, that is computed not using all of f, but using merely the restriction of f to some subset, s of x, where s of x contained in E has at most c points. That's what it means for the operator to be bounded depth. Okay. Now, we know that Tf is equal to f on E because it's an extension operator. We know that the norm is bounded as on the slide. That's what we're given. Okay. So now I would like to prove the following lemma. Suppose I have a function on E, and I take any two points in E, and suppose for those two points merely that I have a bound on the norm of F in S of X union S of Y. And suppose that, so let's say the norm of F is less than or equal to 1, then we have the estimate on the slide. Okay. Now, I have a couple of slides to prove, to give the proof of that in detail, but let me try to short circuit them, because time is short. So let me just say, let's modify F. We know that F, right, F is defined in this whole set, E. We don't know what F is doing on E, but we know what F is doing on S of X union X, S of Y. So, because the norm of F on S of X union S of Y is at most 1, we can find some extension of F that at least some function of controlled CM norm that agrees with little f at least on S of X union S of Y. We can take that extension and restrict it to E. We have then modified F on E, but we have not modified it on S of X union S of Y. Okay? We then look at the jet at X of T of the modified F minus the jet of Y at T of the modified F. We then get the estimate in the box simply by Taylor's theorem, because Tf has controlled CM norm for the modified F. But now I don't want to think about the modified F, I want to think about the original F. But it doesn't matter, because the jets at X and Y of T of F are determined not by F, which has been modified, but in fact merely by F restricted to S of X union S of Y, which has not been modified. I hope that was strictly clearer than the slides. Let's look at the slides. Here's an entertaining picture. This sets S of X and S of Y, and we're supposed to estimate the difference between the jets, and here's the proof of the lemma. We've extended, we've modified F, little f, it's the F tilde, it has controlled norm, it's the exact same thing that I just said. So whether I save time, I'm not sure, but there we go. So we've proven the lemma. All right, so now on the one hand, we have used, we know something coming from, oops.
same argument.
All right, so now let's put it all together and produce the refined fineness theorem. So we have our set E, we make our well-separated pairs decomposition. Recall the number of Cartesian products and the number of representatives is big O of capital N, the number of points of E. Okay, so now let's say T is our linear extension operator bound at depth, and so for each X and E, the jet at X and TF is determined by the restriction of F to S of X, and this S has at most C points. And what we want to do is prove the Sharpe finiteness theorem. So I have to produce for you a list of little subsets, S1 through S nu max, so that nu max is only linear, grows only linearly with N, and each one of these subsets is linear. And I have to show you that the norm of F in X of E is at most a constant multiple of the corresponding norms from the little subsets that I've defined. That's what I'm supposed to do. How are we going to do it? Well, for each nu, I'm going to look at the representatives, x nu prime and x nu double prime. I'm going to take the sets s of x nu prime and s of x nu prime that arise from those points by means of the operator of bounded depth, okay? And I'm going to take their union. I'm going to call that s nu. So we already know that there aren't too many of them, and we already know that those are little subsets. Okay? The serious thing to prove is that you can estimate the norm of F and X of E as being bounded above by a constant times the maximum of the corresponding norms for these particular subsets, SU. All right, so let's suppose that on each of the subsets, SU, the norm of F is at most 1. Let's then prove that the norm of F in X of E is at most a constant. Okay, so I'm going to define a Whitney field. Namely, for each X of E, I'm going to apply the extension operator T to my little f, and I'm going to take its jet at X, and that's going to be the polynomial Px, and the collection of all of those is my Whitney field. Now, Tf is equal to F1E, right? T is an extension operator. So Px evaluated at X is equal to F of X. Moreover, we've defined S of nu to be this union, and we know that the norm of F on that union is less than or equal to 1. That's the assumption on F. So, applying the lemma of the glorified warm-up exercise, we conclude that we conclude the estimate in the box. And by definition, each of those jets is one of the P's from my Whitney field, and so I've proven the estimate in the upper box on this slide for those Whitney fields. Okay, so that is that's the estimate that we want from Taylor's theorem and from Whitney's extension theorem, but only for the representatives. We can now apply the glorified warm-up exercise to obtain, after correction in the misprint, to obtain the thing in the lower box. So where it says alpha less than or equal to m minus 1 and mu equals 1 to nu max, instead of looking at all mu, I should look at all x and y in the set E. Okay. So the glorified warm-up exercise tells me that if I can prove that Taylor's theorem type estimate for the representatives, then I have it for any pair of points x, y, and set E. Similar reasoning, but much easier, shows that each of these Px's has bounded derivatives as in the box on this slide. Okay, so I'm not going to explain, but it's similar to what we just did, only much easier. Okay, so I defined the Whitney field with the following two properties. Each one of these Px's has bounded derivatives, as on the slide, and furthermore, the Px and Py for nearby x and y are close, as in the second estimate on the slide. Those are precisely the hypotheses of Whitney's extension theorem for finite sets, and so we obtain a function capital F with controlled Cm norm, whose jet at each point x and e is equal to the polynomial Px. In particular, because Px evaluated at x is equal to f of x, we have capital F equals little f of e, and remember capital F has control norm in the in CM. And so that means little f has an extension with control CM norm, and so by definition of the norm of little f in X of E is at most a constant, and we're done with that. Okay? So assuming that the norm of f is less than or equal to 1 for all of these little subsets S of nu, we've proven that that the norm of f in X of E is at most a control constant. Okay? And so that completes the proof that linear extension operators of bounded depth produce the sharp finiteness theorem, the refined finiteness theorem, little subsets. Okay, now let me just say a few words about the implication that the theorem on the gamma L's implies the existence of a linear extension operator of bounded depth. So remember what that theorem says. It says that the gamma L star is contained in the true gamma where the m on the left-hand side and the right-hand side differ by a constant. So that's the statement of the theorem, and the gamma of xn is the set of all jets of actual interpolants with norm at most m. That's the thing we're trying to compute. Okay, well, in particular then, if gamma L star is not empty, if, for example, we are given a p in gamma L star of xn, then there exists an F which has control norm and which agrees with the data little f on E. And so that's the assertion. The upper box mentions this P, and the lower box removes the P, but they're obviously the same statement. Okay, if gamma L star is not empty, then there exists an interpolant, because gamma L is not empty and gamma L came from interpolants. So the assertion of the theorem on the gammas gives in particular the statement exclamation mark. Now, if you look at the proof of this result, it's constructive, and in particular the proof of exclamation mark is constructive. And if you follow that proof, which I'm going to give you, or at least I'm going to give you a subset of proof over the next two lectures, if you follow that closely and do a little bit of extra work, you can see that every step, everything you do, is linear and of bounded depth. And so you follow through the proof, and so the map from the little f to the capital F that you produce by proving this assertion exclamation mark is a linear extension operator of bounded depth, and that's it. Obviously, I have omitted a whole lot of stuff there. I've omitted all of the hard part, but let's just believe it. We seem to be, by some miracle, we seem to be precisely at 10 o'clock. So the moral of the story is that all of our results on C of M of Rn restricted to finite sets E will follow if we can prove this one fact about gammas. And so the next two lectures will sketch the proof of that.
Any questions?
Oh, yeah. I am asking the right question. So whenever you mention about removing the outliers,
yes.
Is there any computational studies about whenever you remove these outliers one by one, how fast it is the norm is converging with the best one that you're looking for? Like,
oh.
Is it linearly or exponentially?
It depends completely on the particular problem. Given any rate, you can produce that rate. Now maybe underlying your question is some model of how the data actually arise. That then becomes an important question about which I know nothing. I'm almost always just assuming that the data are given, and in fact I'm assuming that the data are given by some evil opponent who is trying to make my life as hard as possible. And so what happens in the real world, I don't know. And it's a good question, so thank you for asking.
Somewhat related, in the theorem of removing outliers, at least, I mean, there's something the proof seems to be algebraic, in the sense that is there a geometric which I understand to depend on the set E and the function F, of what, how would this sense, I mean, the worst sense that you choose first look like? Meaning whether a certain geometric configuration is more likely to produce the worst case, and then
I would naively suppose that when you get these sets, the ones that somehow lie are small or lie close to an algebraic variety of low degree, you know, zero set of a polynomial of low degree, those are perhaps the most dangerous. But I imagine that if you give me the set E, remember, if you give me the set E, I can produce the list of little subsets before looking at the function little f. And so once I've produced those sets, I can probably pick out any one of them and probably fudge my data so that that one is the worst. That's not completely clear because these sets overlap, so you can't analyze them independently. But that's, I'm free associating to your question. Don't know what results, if any, are true along those lines or others.
Okay, so let's depart now and reconvene in 30 minutes.
I said before.
All right, at 10:30. Yeah, 10:30.
Are you? Yes.
So the
idea is here. Oh, yes.
So the problem is that it's a lot of
issues. And then you don't have to play. We saw that our I is part one, and then the right.
Thank you.
Send my talk to you an email.